Chapter 39. Changed the air, and made an imperfect sort of music in it that would have been melody in the country. The rooms were sparely furnished, but with good store of books. Everything expressed the abode of a poor student. That Mr. Crisparkle had been either chooser, lender, or donor of the books, or that he combined the three characters, might have been easily seen in the friendly beam of his eyes upon them as he entered. How goes it, Neville? I am in good heart, Mr. Crisparkle, and working away. I wish your eyes were not quite so large, and not quite so bright, said the Minor Canon, slowly releasing the hand he had taken in his. They brighten at the sight of you, returned Neville. If you were to fall away from me, they would soon be dull enough. Urged the other, in a stimulating tone. Fight for it, Neville. If I were dying, I feel as if a word from you would rally me. If my pulse had stopped, I feel as if your touch would make it beat again, said Neville. But I have rallied, and am doing famously. Mr. Crisparkle turned him with his face a little more towards the light. I want to see a ruddier touch here, Neville, he said, indicating his own healthy cheek by way of pattern. I want more sun to shine upon you. Neville drooped suddenly, as he replied in a lowered voice. I am not hardy enough for that, yet. I may become so, but I cannot bear it yet. If you had gone through those Cloisterham streets as I did, if you had seen, as I did, those averted eyes, and the better sort of people silently giving me too much room to pass, that I might not touch them, or come near them, you wouldn't think it quite unreasonable, that I cannot go about in the daylight. My poor fellow. Said the Minor Canon, in a tone so purely sympathetic, that the young man caught his hand. I never said it was unreasonable. Never thought so. But I should like you to do it. And that would give me the strongest motive to do it. But I cannot yet. I cannot persuade myself that the eyes of even the stream of strangers I pass in this vast city look at me without suspicion. I feel marked and tainted, even when I go out as I do only at night. But the darkness covers me then, and I take courage from it. Mr. Crisparkle laid a hand upon his shoulder, and stood looking down at him. If I could have changed my name, said Neville, I would have done so. But as you wisely pointed out to me, I can't do that, for it would look like guilt. If I could have gone to some distant place, I might have found relief in that, but the thing is not to be thought of, for the same reason. Hiding and escaping would be the construction in either case. It seems a little hard to be so tied to a stake, and innocent. But I don't complain. And you must expect no miracle to help you, Neville, said Mr. Crisparkle, compassionately. No, sir, I know that. The ordinary fullness of time and circumstances is all I have to trust to. It will right you at last, Neville. So I believe, and I hope I may live to know it. But perceiving that the despondent mood into which he was falling cast a shadow on the Minor Canon, and, it may be, feeling that the broad hand upon his shoulder was not then quite as steady as its own natural strength had rendered it, when it first touched him just now, he brightened and said, "Excellent circumstances for study, anyhow. And you know, Mr. Crisparkle, what need I have of study in all ways. Not to mention, that you have advised me to study for the difficult profession of the law, specially, and that of course I am guiding myself by the advice of such a friend and helper. Such a good friend and helper." He took the fortifying hand from his shoulder, and kissed it. Mr. Crisparkle beamed at the books, but not so brightly as when he had entered. "I gather from your silence on the subject that my late guardian is adverse, Mr. Crisparkle?" The Minor Canon answered. Your late guardian is a most unreasonable person, and it signifies nothing to any reasonable person whether he is adverse, perverse, or the reverse. Apostrophe, well for me, that I have enough with economy to live upon. Apostrophe, sighed Neville, half wearily and half cheerily, while I wait to be learned, and wait to be righted. Else I might have proved the proverb, that while the grass grows, the steed starves. Apostrophe, apostrophe, he opened some books as he said it, and was soon immersed in their interleaved and annotated passages, while Mr. Crisparkle sat beside him, expounding, correcting, and advising. The minor canon's cathedral duties made these visits of his difficult to accomplish, and only to be compassed at intervals of many weeks. But they were as serviceable as they were precious to Neville Landless. When they had got through such studies as they had in hand, they stood leaning on the windowsill, and looking down upon the patch of garden. Next week, apostrophe said Mr. Crisparkle, you will cease to be alone, and will have a devoted companion. Apostrophe, and yet, apostrophe returned Neville, this seems an uncongenial place, to bring my sister to. Apostrophe, I don't think so, apostrophe said the minor canon. There is duty to be done here, and there are womanly feeling, sense, and courage wanted here. Apostrophe, I meant, apostrophe explained Neville, that the surroundings are so dull and unwomanly, and that Helena can have no suitable friend or society here. Apostrophe, you have only to remember, apostrophe said Mr. Crisparkle, that you are here yourself, and that she has to draw you into the sunlight. Apostrophe, they were silent for a little while, and then Mr. Crisparkle began anew. When we first spoke together, Neville, you told me that your sister had risen out of the disadvantages of your past lives as superior to you as the tower of Cloisterham Cathedral is higher than the chimneys of Minor Canon Corner. Do you remember that? Apostrophe, right well. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I was inclined to think it at the time an enthusiastic flight. No matter what I think it now. What I would emphasize is, that under the head of pride your sister is a great, and opportune example to you. Apostrophe, under all heads, that are included in the composition of a fine character, she is. Apostrophe, say so, but take this one. Your sister has learned, how to govern what is proud in her nature. She can dominate it, even when it is wounded through her sympathy with you. No doubt she has suffered deeply in those same streets where you suffer deeply. No doubt her life is darkened by the cloud that darkens yours. But bending her pride into a grand composure that is not haughty or aggressive, but is a sustained confidence in you and in the truth, she has won her way through those streets until she passes along them as high in the general respect as anyone who treads them. Every day and hour of her life since Edwin Drood's disappearance, she has faced malignity and folly for you as only a brave nature well-directed can. So it will be with her to the end. Another and weaker kind of pride might sink broken-hearted, but never such a pride as hers, which knows no shrinking, and can get no mastery over her. Apostrophe, the pale cheek beside him flushed under the comparison, and the hint implied in it. I will do all I can to imitate her, apostrophe said Neville. Do so, and be a truly brave man, as she is a truly brave woman, apostrophe answered Mr. Crisparkle stoutly. It is growing dark. Will you go my way with me, when it is quite dark? Mind. It is not I who wait for darkness. Apostrophe, Neville replied, that he would accompany him directly. But Mr. Crisparkle said he had a moment's call to make on Mr. Grewgious as an act of courtesy, and would run across to that gentleman's chambers, and rejoin Neville on his own doorstep, if he would come down there to meet him. Mr. Grewgious, bolt upright as usual, sat taking his wine in the dusk at his open window, his wineglass and decanter on the round table at his elbow, himself and his legs on the window seat. Only one hinge in his whole body, like a bootjack. How do you do, Reverend Sir? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Grewgious, with abundant offers of hospitality, which were as cordially declined as made. And how is your charge getting on over the way in the set that I had the pleasure of recommending to you as vacant and eligible? Mr. Crisparkle replied suitably. I am glad you approve of them, said Mr. Grugis, because I entertain a sort of fancy for having him under my eye. As Mr. Grugis had to turn his eye up considerably before he could see the chambers, the phrase was to be taken figuratively and not literally. And how did you leave Mr. Jasper, Reverend Sir? Said Mr. Grugis. Mr. Crisparkle had left him pretty well. And where did you leave Mr. Jasper, Reverend Sir? Mr. Crisparkle had left him at Cloisterham. And when did you leave Mr. Jasper, Reverend Sir? That morning. Said Mr. Grugis. He didn't say he was coming, perhaps? Coming where? Anywhere, for instance? Said Mr. Grugis. No. Because here he is, said Mr. Grugis, who had asked all these questions, with his preoccupied glance directed out at window. And he don't look agreeable, does he? Mr. Crisparkle was craning towards the window, when Mr. Grugis added, if you will kindly step round here behind me, in the gloom of the room, and will cast your eye at the second floor landing window in yonder house, I think you will hardly fail to see a slinking individual in whom I recognize our local friend. You are right. Cried Mr. Crisparkle. Said Mr. Grugis. Then he added, turning his face so abruptly that his head nearly came into collision with Mr. Crisparkle's. What should you say that our local friend was up to? The last passage he had been shown in the diary returned on Mr. Crisparkle's mind with the force of a strong recoil, and he asked Mr. Grugis if he thought it possible that Neville was to be harassed by the keeping of a watch upon him? A watch? Repeated Mr. Grugis musingly. Which would not only of itself haunt and torture his life, said Mr. Crisparkle warmly, but would expose him to the torment of a perpetually reviving suspicion, whatever he might do, or wherever he might go. Said Mr. Grugis musingly still. Do I see him waiting for you? No doubt you do. Then would you have the goodness to excuse my getting up to see you out, and to go out to join him, and to go the way that you were going, and to take no notice of our local friend? Said Mr. Grugis. I entertain a sort of fancy for having him under my eye tonight, do you know? Mr. Crisparkle, with a significant nod, complied, and rejoining Neville, went away with him. They dined together, and parted at the yet unfinished and undeveloped railway station. Mr. Crisparkle to get home, Neville to walk the streets, cross the bridges, make a wide round of the city in the friendly darkness, and tire himself out. It was midnight when he returned from his solitary expedition, and climbed his staircase. The night was hot, and the windows of the staircase were all wide open. Coming to the top, it gave him a passing chill of surprise there being no rooms, but his up there, to find a stranger sitting on the windowsill, more after the manner of a venturesome glazier than an amateur ordinarily careful of his neck. In fact, so much more outside the window than inside, as to suggest the thought that he must have come up by the water spout instead of the stairs. The stranger said nothing until Neville put his key in his door. Then, seeming to make sure of his identity from the action, he spoke. I beg your pardon, he said, coming from the window with a frank and smiling air, and a prepossessing address, the Beans. Neville was quite at a loss. Runners, said the visitor. Scarlet. Next door at the back. Returned Neville, and the mignonette and wallflower? Apostrophe, the same, apostrophe, said the visitor. Pray walk in. Apostrophe, thank you. Apostrophe, Neville lighted his candles, and the visitor sat down. A handsome gentleman, with a young face, but with an older figure in its robustness and its breadth of shoulder. Say a man of 28, or at the utmost 30, so extremely sunburned that the contrast between his brown visage and the white forehead shaded out of doors by his hat and the glimpses of white throat below the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.